Let's sing and swing.
Evening visit with Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt.
2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon in Manila.
Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowther, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines. Episode 26, Going Underground. Previously on Forbidden Diary.
People's reaction to Mr. Tomibe's family unit plan has been surprising. In the rice room, in the kitchen, the battle rages.
Honestly, it has reached the point where if you want a family life, you're immoral, and if you don't want it, you don't love your husband.
Bill Moole was taken to town for questioning.
What did they do to you?
They put my hands behind me and, pulled me up by my thumbs.
People are starting to sell the clothes off their backs to people in town to get money for food.
And now, episode 26.
April 16, 1944. With Jim, Bill, and Jean out of prison, the camp's attention has returned to the family unit plan. We're still bickering about whether to let families live together. But one decision has been made. Each barrack will decide separately whether they want families living together, which leaves little hope for Jerry and me, because both of our barracks are against it. The vote takes place in a few days, so committee members have posted charts proposing the size and placement of family cubicles in each barrack. One was posted in our ironing room, with two people on hand to explain and accept suggestions. I can't believe what went on. You weren't there in the ironing room, Jerry. I was shocked, just shocked, at Walter's reaction to the floor plans.
What did he do?
He said the family unit plan would be harmful to the camp and against all our best interests.
Really? I'm surprised.
Well, me too. And then he said if people wanted to begin the begin, they should take to the bushes.
He said that in front of women?
Yes. And he sneered when he said it.
Jeez, I'd never think Walter'd say something like that. At least, not around women.
Well, men were there too. But then he really showed his cards when he ended his tirade by saying, if one member of my family has to move 1 inch, there will be hell to pay.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, there it is.
There it is indeed. The real reason for all of the righteous indignation around here.
People don't want to lose any of their floor space.
Not one precious inch. Harry took one look at the cubicle chart and said he's going to start a petition against it.
Oh, brother.
And I'm so disappointed in John. He's one of the most intellectual men in the camp.
What did he do?
He's decided against family units because he'd have to move and doesn't want to disrupt his Greek studies.
John too, huh?
Yes. Even General Ko says we can cohabitate any way we please as long as we use the present buildings and don't construct new ones.
Well, if both our barracks vote against
it... Well, then we'll just have to break the rules and visit whenever we like. The Japanese don't care.
The vote's in a few days. No use crying before you're hurt. And anyway, I think there may be another way to skin this cat.
How?
I'll let you know when I'm sure.
April 18, 1944. I knew it. Both my barracks and Jerry's voted against family units, or cubicles, as they are now being called. Mrs. Sproul came in to talk to me about my space in June's. Our combined allotment is 70 square feet. I told her that I've never taken my full share of floor space because I didn't think it mattered. But now, it does. I said that I'm going to move my bed around, occupy my full space, and put up a sheet for privacy so I won't have to look at my neighbors anymore.
While our confab was going on, two women in the room were staring avidly. It's quite evident they believe the rumor that Jerry is going to move in. April 19, 1944. With the vote over, you'd think that the family unit debate would be settled, but it's not. The barracks that voted for family cubicles are still facing opposition.
Petition against cubicle plans. We, the undersigned members of Camp Holmes, wish to present to the General Committee our protest against family units. Naturally, we have no objection to couples living together under normal conditions. However, times are not normal. The scheme will result inevitably in pregnancies, drawing on our meager stores for the care of expectant mothers. In addition, family units will subject the camp to an intimacy that's offensive to standards of propriety and even of decency. Moreover, they threaten further bitterness, quarreling, and untold possibilities of embarrassment.
Dr. Skirl countered the petition point by point, and Father Sheridan wrote an open letter to the camp.
To Camp Holmes internees. Even strong men had lumps in their throats, witnessing the reunion of Bill Moole with his family when he returned from being questioned by the military police about Wicks and Richie's escape. As Bill and his wife cried and laughed in anguish and joy, I had a vision of how deeply they must still be in love. Celibate priest that I am, I vowed through sobs that I'll pay any price to bring such families together, not only for their companionship, but especially for the mutual protection they can afford in the days as yet unborn, when we shall perhaps be penniless, hungry, and obsessed with fears of what may befall the islands, this camp, and ourselves.
April 20, 1944. At breakfast, there were three cartoons on the bulletin board. One made fun of Father Sheridan's letter, and the other two were lewd. The room was full of sniggers and giggles. Harry was laughing very superior. But it's all lies, and no joke to me anymore. Later, when I saw one of the privileged fathers in his little cottage helping with the lunch and dishes, something exploded in me. I marched to the dining hall bulletin board and pinned up my sign next to the cartoons that screamed, "Lost! The holy state of matrimony, for better, for worse. Finder, please return to Father Sheridan." A group of camp leaders huddled around the board and took everything down promptly, which suited me fine. Beatty hears and sees these things and wants to know what it is all about, especially the smutty stuff. We walked up and down the parade ground, talking out the whole problem. When Beatty asked about my tirades today, I didn't know where to begin.
You almost cried two times, Mother.
Well, Beatty, I'm angry, very angry, and tired of people snickering over things that aren't funny.
I don't get what's going on. Why are the adults so mad about families living together?
Well, some of them are worried about, impropriety.
Huh?
They're worried about people mating, Beatty. Okay? Okay. How do I put this? People think differently about it. Some are made so that they need it more often than others, and some less.
It's like Mike and me are girl crazy, but Henry isn't.
Kind of. I hope you aren't teasing Henry about that, Beatty.
No.
You'd better not be. Look, the people I'm disagree with are the ones who think the only reason for marriage is mating. And they're just wrong, Beatty. Don't let anyone tell you it's the only reason people want to live together. Companionship and being with someone you love and wanting to tell the world about it are what count most.
I don't think it's fair that we can't live together just because some people don't like mating.
No, It's not fair. And it's not just that. They can't face the fact that millions of families live in one room, close to others. And while it isn't ideal, it is possible.
I really want all of us to live together.
Me too, sweetie.
And you can be happy living in a little bit of space, can't you?
You absolutely can. We talked clear and straight. I told Beatty he would probably fall in love a number of times before he found the girl he wanted to marry, but hoped he would try to keep himself clean and decent for her, not getting common or cheap, trying to find out what it was all about. We had to cut the conversation short when the school bell rang, but we grew closer, and Beatty heard some facts that will stick by him, or come back strongly someday. April 22nd, 1944. Ingenuity has saved us again. Families who can't live together are going underground. Literally. People are building cubicles underneath the barracks. The Thompsons have theirs nearly built, so Betty gave me a tour. As we crept along with bent backs, I hit my head on a rafter, and she exclaimed,
"Oh dear, do look out, Natalie. We are entering the underworld. Here we are. What do you think?"
"I love it."
"It took Reggie 3 days to build our little room. The walls are all discarded wood and tin. I swapped a sweater for some canvas to make coverings for those 3 windows. Pretty good trade, don't you think?"
"I'll say. Has Mr. Tomibe approved this?"
"He knows about them and hasn't complained. After all, he's the one who came up with the family unit plan, isn't he?"
April 23rd, 1944. A complaint was lodged about the underground cubicles. So Mr. Tomibe inspected them with another officer. They asked how many cubicles in all and were told 10. To that, Mr. Tomibe nodded and said,
"Very good. Very good."
I think the Japanese got a big kick out of the ingenuity displayed. No two cubicles are alike. The Mansell's is huge. Already has a window with 2 panes of glass. They plan to have a door, curtains, couch, chair, all on a grand scale. The Carters will be like a ship's saloon, with curtains at porthole windows. All are being made from scrap, but they spell quiet, privacy, and happiness. April 25th, 1944. After morning chores, I dragged myself in for a blood count. A few hours later, the doctor called me back to say my red and white cell count has dropped by a third. He prescribed iron pills and 10 more ascorbic shots. I may get liver shots if the medical committee approves. They have only 15 left. April 27, 1944. 2 years ago today, 800 of us, including Chinese, moved to Camp Holmes. Happy anniversary to us. Another internee was questioned about Wick and Richie's escape. After returning from jail, looking tired and wan, he was forbidden to talk about it under serious penalty and had to sign a paper to this effect. The entire camp must sign another oath not to escape or conspire against Japan. And there is talk about electrifying the outer fence to 300 volts. Despite this, Mr. Tomibe continues to find ways to help and reach out to us. He has even visited Japanese class, talking in Japanese with his eyes shut tight in thought sometimes, his hands and arms in use, his thick black hair tossed now and then. Miss McKim translates beautifully, subtle in catching the shades and nuances of both languages. The two together are fascinating.
Class? Class? We are honored to have Tomibe-san with us today. He is going to tell us the story of the 47 Ronin in Japanese. I will translate, but encourage you to try to understand Japanese. Tomibe-san, 今日は来てくれて本当にありがとうございます。Tomibe-san, we are all so grateful that you have taken time to be here with us.
Makimu-san, ここにいられることを光栄に思います。日本語を学ぶことで、あなたの生徒たちが日本の精神や特性について少しでも理解を深められることを願っています。
Tomibe-san says he is honored to be here. He hopes that through your study of Japanese, you will gain a little insight into Japanese spirit and character.
この物語は中心蔵と呼ばれています。
This story is called The 47 Ronins.
時を遡って、江戸湾の岸辺に立っている自分の姿を想像してください。穏やかな斜面に広がる美しい風景に寺社が点在し、松の木が海へと続く道沿いに並び、漁船が浮かぶ海が望める場所です。
Tomibe-san asks you all to step back in time and fancy yourselves on the shores of the Bay of Yedo, a fair, smiling landscape of gentle slopes, dotted with temples and fringed with pines that lead down to the sea, studded with fishing boats.
西の遥か彼方、小山の鬼が徘徊する高地がそびえ立ち、その先には無比の火山山脈、富士が孤高で雄大にそびえ立っています。数世紀にわたり、その巨大な山は平和を保ってきました。
Far away to the west looms the goblin-haunted heights of Oyama, and beyond that, Fujiyama, the peerless volcanic mountain, solitary and grand. For centuries, the huge mountain has been at peace.
しかし、頻繁な地震は内部の火山活動を示しており、誰にも富士が再び噴火する時期を予測することはできません。
But frequent earthquakes betray the fires within, and no one can say when Fujiyama will erupt again.
江戸の真ん中、古気が密集する中に隠れるように立つ仙岳寺は、四十七人の赤穂浪士の墓所として広く知られています。
In the midst of Yedo, hidden amongst a nest of venerable trees, is the Sengakuji Temple.Renowned far and wide for its cemetery, which contains the graves of the 47 Ronin, whose tales of heroic deeds I am about to describe.
仙岳寺の本堂の左側には礼拝堂があり、その中には。
April 28, 1944. I woke at 1 a.m. with poor respiration and my sight cloudy. For a couple of weeks, I've been having lapses of memory. After breakfast, I went to Peg and told her I was resigning all my jobs for a week or month's rest to conserve what strength I have for my family, who may have to look after me. Unfortunately, I am not the only one who is ill and needs help. There are many others.May 1, 1944. Practice for the maypole dancing and monotonous piano tunes tinkling for days ended after today's program. One of the men who had been tortured by the Kempeitai watched, his head still with that beaten, battered look, swollen here, sunken there, and eyes tragically not normal.Families continue to move into their new cubicles in the barracks. Moving and hammering surges while people against the family unit plan refuse to move an inch. They remain obdurate islands. But Mr. Tomibe says to go by them. For days, the camp has looked like an anthill with men carrying trunks, bags, beds, shelves, and all kinds of dunnage. It's inspiring to watch husbands and wives working together. The creative effort put into constructing beds, economizing on space, and storing possessions boosts morale for some and curdles it for others. Jerry and I took a tour of a barrack that voted in favor of families living together. After what happened to Bill Moole, we were surprised that he and Marge had the wherewithal to fix up a space. But I think it did them some good. See, Jerry? Everyone's using sheets for partitions like us.
This barracks looks like a cross between the inside of a trailer and a Pullman car.
Hi, Jerry and Natalie. Want to come see our place?
Oh, we'd love to, Marge.
Follow me. We're over in the corner. Bill, we've got visitors.
Hi, Jerry, Natalie. Come on in.
Thanks.
Oh, hey, let me crank up the bed.
How'd you build that pull-up bed so quickly?
Bunch of guys helped.
Everyone's been so great after Bill came back.
Here we go. Grab a seat.
Man, your place looks swell.
It really does. You two have done a wonderful job.
Thanks. The trick is everything has to do double duty. That desk folds out into a table, and when the stools aren't being used, we stack them up and use them for end tables.
Have you seen the Finley's cubicle?
No.
They have the trickiest little place. It's even got a kitchenette curtained with red-checked napkins. It's really cute.
Where's everyone getting the building materials?
From the Presbyterian missionaries. Yeah, I don't know how they managed to keep their property from the Japanese, but they're tearing down some vacation cottages their church owns in Baguio and donating the salvage to the camp. I guess Mr. Tomibe's okay with that.
I'll have to keep that in mind.
I was expecting it to be a lot noisier in here.
I was worried about that too, but it's actually quieter now. Little kids aren't roaring up and down the aisles screaming and fighting.
I wonder why that is.
Kids pay attention to a deep male voice.
They know they can't get away with as much with their fathers around.
Unless their children happen to be teenage daughters.
And you don't have to hunt down each other all over camp.
No, thank God. The kids are home before dinner because Mom and Dad say so. It's so much better.
They aren't keyed up from tearing around camp from dawn to dark.
I swear they wind each other up.
I can deal with my own ankle biters, but other people's...
A lot of the stress is gone.
I'm so glad for you guys, especially after all you two've been through.
But we feel bad for you and Jerry.
Are you going to build a cubicle under one of the barracks?
Yep. We've got a space under number 2 barracks. Beatty's helping me with the digging.
His slogan is cubicle or bust.
It's going to be a snug fit down there.
I don't care. Anything to get away from all the pettiness. Everyone seems so happy over here.
We really are. I'm hoping that the kids' nightmares will go away now that their daddy's nearby.
May 2nd, 1944. Another rumor says that Roosevelt has given Japan 45 days for women and children to evacuate 7 of their cities. In response, the Japanese have abandoned all defensive efforts in 8 cities, including Tokyo. This news is old, so we figure that Japan has 2 days. Perhaps this is one of the reasons for jitters, nerves, and tightening up as we wait like the blind and the deaf for America to reach the Philippines. Our underground cubicle will be an excellent shelter in which to lie low in case bullets or shrapnel fly during retreat or battle. May 3rd, 1944. Joe loaned Jerry 100 pesos. We are so desperate for food and medical supplies that it seemed like the hand of the Lord. Lately, I've been wondering if my shoes might get perhaps maybe 30 pesos on the outside. So Jerry and I approached Carl, who is sometimes allowed to go into Baguio. I was surprised when Carl said they would fetch 170 pesos. When he told us that jewelry goes for better, Jerry answered,
Natalie's got a diamond bracelet, but it'd probably sell for more cash than we'd want.
If you're willing to part with it and the Japanese consent, you could give a chunk of it to one of the missionary groups. I know they'd guarantee repayment.
Gee. I only have 3 big pieces of jewelry left.
It makes a lot of sense, Natalie, and we need food and medicine.
Well, why don't you think it over?
No, Carl, I'm going to do it. One more thing isn't going to matter. And it'll go to people who really need it.
Are you sure, Natalie?
Yes. And tell them there's no strings attached. Do you want it now? Jerry cleaned the diamond bracelet, and I held it and looked at it in the sun. Then one wrench, and it was gone. The sign and symbol of our gains from the gold boom. A gift from Jerry. One more item to put on my list of things bought for one purpose and used for quite another. May 6, 1944. After breakfast, I went over to Peg's to lie down. Elizabeth was having her bed swung to the ceiling, and my head couldn't take the hammering. At Peg's, I began to get cold hands and feet, poor circulation all over. Peg made me an eggnog, and June managed to find 2 hot water bags. I drank gallons of water and didn't feel like fainting, but my vitality was so low that I had to fight for control, holding on by a thread with my balance slipping. As I began to come back, June, looking me over like a doctor, said,
You look a lot better, Mother.
Why? How did I look before?
Your face was pinched and drawn. Your eyes looked bad, and your mouth was pulled and strained.
My Junie answered like an adult. No longer a little girl. Jerry appeared with coffee and an anxious face. Then called the doctor who examined me and said, I need meat and a lot else. I must go slow. Somehow Jerry managed to buy pot roast with gravy for dinner. Flavors we haven't tasted in months that made me want to weep. After my episode, I literally cut myself out of my girdle, which is so completely patched that it has no more elasticity, and is molded on to hold up a torn and patched pair of stockings. They're my last ones, except for one fresh pair that I'm saving for when we're rescued.
Camp Bulletin. A new ruling has come into effect. Relatives living outside may now bring clothes and toilet articles once a week on Sunday mornings to the guardhouse. No food is allowed.
May 9, 1944. I am now trying to enjoy a woman in our dorm as a study in psychology. In the middle of a world war, in the middle of an internment camp, this woman, whom I call Sheba, still maintains a routine of constant pampering. June and I time her shampoos during the week. She is always washing her hair, having it done up by expert hands more and more often. In the morning, she wears a crystal choker with a lacy string sweater and slacks. She can stay dressed up all day because someone in the family does the hard work in food preparation for her, and the family meals as well. She has a complex beyond doubt. Having plenty of money, with people kowtowing, has built it up in this particular setup. Today, she's wearing another new sweater, this time with a big needle weave of yellow and brown. Last week, it was bright yellow. June says that Sheba will go mad if she runs out of wool. She'll probably unravel and re-knit when her skeins run out, for she sits up in the dark, knitting by the outside light until nearly midnight.
When I cannot sleep, I often hear her needles clicking.
May 12, 1944. The family unit plan, like a forest fire, has swept beyond stopping. In addition to cubicles inside and underneath the barracks, people are building bankside shacks. The lean-tos are so amusing, with roofs of canvas, tin, grass, or woven branches. Some are very disheveled. Others are neat, with flowers already growing in prim but scant borders. The owners drink their tea on log benches, dirt-terraced couches, plank settees, or chairs created with no two pieces of wood alike. A bulletin was posted outside the dining hall saying that anyone caught with a shortwave set will now be shot. No more bother with jail terms. May 14, 1944. Our little town under No. 2 Barracks has become a help-each-other community. We share tools, materials, and anything else we can scavenge. Everything is made from salvage. Bent, rusty, bedraggled, worn, making us look like a miniature Greenwich Village. Jerry traded a mattress cover for electrical wire, so in time, we'll even have electricity. May 16, 1944. Afternoon rains are here. Last evening brought quite a gale. In between showers, Jerry and Beattie moved our table into our underground cubicle, as June and I sewed together furoshikis, which are squares of decorative fabric the Japanese use to wrap packages.
Where do you want Beattie and me to put the table, girls?
Put it by the couch, in the center of the back wall.
What couch?
The one you're going to terrace into the back wall.
Oh, I am I?
Yes.
It's going to be hard as a rock.
No, it isn't.
We're going to pad it with straw mats and cover it with a thick blanket.
Okay, Beattie boy. Grab it into the table.
Look out for the rafter overhead, you two.
You got anything to eat, Mom?
Not here. You'll have to go back to the barracks.
Aren't we living down here?
Not right now, Beattie. We'll have to see.
Mom, I thought we were going to move out of the barracks.
Not completely. We're still keeping our spaces.
Why?
It's called hedging your bets, son. What if this place leaks during the rainy season, or one of us gets sick? We'll have a place to go back to. Your mom and I think it's best.
If we're gonna do that, can I have a sleepover down here with my friends?
No.
Why?
Because I'm not going to chaperone four teenage boys in a dugout.
You don't have to do that. I'm 13.
You'd burn the place down smoking those corn tassel cigarettes.
No, we won't.
The answer is no.
Why?
Beattie, I'm not changing my mind.
June, will you pass me another furoshiki? Thanks. I think 6 squares will be enough to cover the tin wall.
It better. It's got some pretty big holes and 4 girls are moving in next to us.
Don't worry. No one will see us.
That fabric looks familiar.
It should. It was in the trunk that came from Baguio last month.
Was that in there? I didn't think we'd ever use all that junk, except to sell it.
That blanket we got on the ship from our last trip to the U.S. was in there too. Remember?
No.
It's gonna go on top of the couch. We're going to put straw mats under the blanket to make it cushy.
We're going for a strong Nipponese look with a bit of a bohemian flair. May 17, 1944. Our underground dugout is heaven. To get out of that dorm room, hear no more opinions or sour critics, is heaven. We've had all of our meals there, and I've spent the whole day resting and reading on the couch that Jerry terraced into the back wall. A box is our cupboard, and Dr. Hall's wooden tray makes a good buffet, with the silver Spanish candlestick and two chromium plates catching highlights. Two hand-carved trays are propped against the dirt wall on a ledge. Agate, silver, and tin cups hang above from the rafters. It's compact, casual. A real home. May 18, 1944. Jerry woke me at 6:30 and I dressed quickly. With a cup of coffee in hand and a bun, we sauntered up to the hospital and watched the sunrise over a soft blanket of clouds on one ridge. The sea was vague and far away in the distance. It was a tender beauty, delicate dawn colors. Behind us, the Episcopalians chanted early Mass of Ascension Day. As we sat there, Jerry broke the news about my diamond bracelet.
I'm sorry, honey. Carl said it'd sell for too many pesos to get into camp right now.
Well, what about my Igorot earrings? They're gold.
Just give me one of them, and I'll have it weighed. I'm thinking it'll bring in about 200 pesos.
How long do you think that'll carry us?
Well, with what we already have, and if prices don't go up, maybe 4 weeks.
May 19, 1944. Now that construction is mostly finished, everyone is pleased with their new family cubicles. All my time is spent in our underground dugout, which delights me out of all proportion to what we've put into it. For the children, it is home. It is a warm, quiet, colorful gathering place. I lie here for hours, doing nothing, just recuperating. Everything is simple. We have only to reach out a hand for a spoon, plate, or cup. No effort, yet paradise enough. Jerry likes to putter about, putting in small additions. But for me, it is finished. I can finally relax and catch up a little, as I am out of steam and need to gather strength after weeks of sleepless nights and months of sore mouth and going downhill. Thank God, the doctors chose me to get the last of the liver shots sent by the Red Cross. May 20, 1944. Peg and Walter and Carl came for coffee before we all went to hear Walter Neal speaking on Mexico and see an amusing drama skit with Blackie, Johnny, and Carol as three cowboys singing ranch songs. They were so good that the children whistled, stamped, banged, and begged for more. But when we came back home, Beatty was homesick. He says our dugout is not enough. The cowboy songs reminded him of Nida and Ismail, who used to sing Yippee-ki-yay. He wept on my shoulder.
This concludes episode 26. Be sure to tune in for the next episode of Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowder, based on her secret journal, written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines.